Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Welcome to Murder
and Mimosas,
a true crime podcast brought to you by a mother and daughter duo,
bringing you murder stories with a mimosas in hand.
Just a quick disclaimer before we get started. Our show is Murder and Mimosas, a true crime podcast. This means that we do discuss crimes, including but not limited to disappearances, murder, and sexual assault. All our episodes are told with the respect of the victims and the victims' families in mind. We strive to ensure that we provide factual information, but some information is more verifiable than others. With that, grab your mimosas and let's dive in. Welcome back to Murder and Mimosas. I'm Danica.
And I'm Shannon.
Today, we are going to talk to you about serial killer Gary Hilton. So grab your mimosas, you sip, while we share. Let's set the scene. New Year's Day, 2008. Many people are waking up to hangovers, and they're throwing their black-eyed peas in the pot to cook for the day. All right. But Meredith Emerson woke up, and she decided to start the year off on the right foot by taking a hike. She takes her black lab, Ella, and they head out. She leaves her roommate a note on the chalkboard that her and Ella were going for a hike. And the next day, her roommate was called by a coworker when Meredith didn't show up for work. This is not in Meredith's nature to ditch work, and especially not to ditch and not call. Her roommate and friends split up to try and find her. They find her car at the trailhead of Blood Mountain, but there is no trace of Meredith or Ella. So what on earth could have happened to them? Once they see her car there, they call police. And the police start to search the area. The friends are searching the area. Go up the mountain trying to locate them. They're very quick to get the news out, and people frantically start searching. Leads immediately start coming in, and many say they saw her with a man. He was described as being kind of wiry, about 160, poor dental hygiene, 50 to 60 years old, and he had an adorable, darkish, reddish retriever with him, and he was seen driving a white van.
Interesting description. Not gonna lie, I'm a little stuck on the poor dental hygiene. I mean, are we talking like mouth plaque buildup or meth mouth or what?
I know it's kind of disturbing, like as a mental image, but I'm gonna tell you more about that momentarily. So while they're looking for Meredith, they notice that someone is trying to use her debit card several times. From the video, the person's wearing a mask, but they are never able to get out any money because they don't have the correct PIN. This gives me flashback to the gold marks.
Right.
So tips do come in from like this man's description, and there's one that's very promising. John Tabor sees the story on the news, and he calls the tip line. He tells them this man has to be Gary Hinton. He used to work for John about 9 to 10 years, doing mostly like siding work. He tells him he doesn't really know where Gary is now, but that he does have a white van and he does have a dog that fits the description. John had recently fired Gary. He says the last time he saw him, his appearance had changed drastically. Gary smiled and he was missing some teeth. John, of course, asked Gary what happened to his teeth, and he said he took pliers and pulled them out. Of course, John, a little sane here, says, why on earth would you do that? And Gary's like, says he loves the way it scares people when he does it.
He is seriously just pulling his teeth out to try to get a rise out of people?
Yeah, maybe he should have been a dentist. But that's what he tells John. But there's the answer to your question about his dental hygiene. It's really more like missing teeth. So John had gone over to fire him, though, because he just pretty much stopped working. Gary said that John still owed him money, and John refused to pay him because he didn't actually owe him anything. So then Gary starts to harass him and he threatens to kill him. Well, John took this seriously. And honestly, if a guy's willing to pull his teeth out just for fun, I would take it seriously too.
Right.
So he gets a rental car, he buys a gun for protection, and he goes to the police about all of this. The problem is they don't really know where Gary is, though. To be honest, at this point, he was living out of his van, so he literally could be anywhere. The GBI issues a BOLO, or a be on the lookout, for Gary for anyone who sees him to call. And there were several calls from people who spotted him, but let's listen to this one specific call.
To this. Okay, I'm 911. What's the exact location?
I have this. The person of interest in that missing woman case is at this Chevron gas station on Ashford Dunwoody.
Chevron gas station at Ashford Dunwoody?
Yeah.
You said the van is there?
The van is here. The dog is here, the red dog. And I saw the man's face. And I've gone to the news and I know him. I know him. He's got a green long-sleeve sweatshirt, and he's wearing a hat, and he's emptying all the stuff out of his van. Pillows and a blanket, and it looks like he's got a sleeping bag right now. Taking out all of the trash. It's definitely
and the dumpster is
around like he's as guilty as sin.
Okay, sir, and the dumpster is at the rear of the location?
Yeah, the dumpster, well, it's kind of right in the front. It's right by the car wash.
Okay.
I can go take him down if you want.
No, sir. Stay right there.
Okay.
Okay. Hold on, sir.
He looks like he's finishing up. You guys gotta hurry. He's got stuff in bags that he's emptied onto the ground, and he's taking them load by load to the strip behind the car wash. Another. This is the third backpack we've seen him into the dumpster. I'm just shaking. Do you guys? Is there somebody in route?
Yes, sir.
I love that. You want me to go take him down? That's the friends you need right there.
Very true. I was laughing so hard because it's so funny. But also, like, he definitely could be the type of person that could get into some trouble. He gives me the vibe that he's probably the one in the bar that says, hold my beer.
True.
But, like you heard from the clip, the police do apprehend Gary, and they take him down to the station for questioning. Gary says nothing. His lips are sealed. They get him an attorney, and they speak to the attorney. And they cut a deal that if Gary tells them what happened and where Meredith's body is, then they will take the death penalty off the table.
At this point, do they actually have anything on him, though?
Well, no. They did take his van in to do forensic testing. And like I mentioned earlier, he was living out of this van with his dog. So there's a lot in there because they're essentially searching his house and van simultaneously since he lives there. So that thing is clearly going to take some time. But they don't have a crime scene. They don't have a body. And really outside of like a gut feeling from some witnessed IDs, they don't really have much of anything. Oddly enough, though, Gary takes the deal. And he tells them that Meredith's body is at Dawson Forest, and he lets them know in advance that she will be unclothed and decapitated. The one thing the police actually already had were some of Meredith's clothes that they had recovered from a dumpster, so they already knew, or at least assumed, that she would be nude.
Does he give any explanation at all as to why he decapitated this poor girl, other than he's a sicko?
Well, yeah, he says he did this to keep them from identifying her. That's also why he claimed to have stripped off her clothes and then went a step further and drenched her body in bleach.
Holy crap. So he thinks if you cut the head off of a body and bleach it, this is all you need to do to get away with murder?
Okay, this is not a defense for him, But like we said a minute ago, there really isn't anything that points to him other than the few sightings. So without those, they wouldn't really have had him at all.
That's true. So was there a motive or a reason he gave for killing her? Or is this just some kind of game to him?
Well, long story short, he killed her because he needed money. He said he only had like $40 to his name and a little bit of food. So he took her life for the money. But Joe was a little bit on him. He got her debit card and wanted her PIN. She gave him numbers, but never the right ones. She told him that clearly it must be the bank and he should try a different bank because the numbers were right. He actually ended up driving around with her for 4 days before he finally killed her. He was trying different ATMs, but he never got any money out of her. And it very much gives me like the gold mark vibes.
Right. So not that I want him to have her money, but this dude killed her for money and he didn't even get any money. So the irony of that. So not to mention good for her because, like you said, he was going to kill her no matter what. So might as well make him suffer.
Yes. And Meredith was actually well-versed in martial arts. So she gave him a run for his money in taking her down too. She actually disarmed him twice.
Okay. She's feisty. I hate she didn't kick his butt, but I'm proud of her for trying. You might as well do all you can because odds are you're not coming out alive.
Yeah, and she truly put up a fight.
I know that a woman died, and this should be the least of my worries, but what happened to the dog, or do we know?
Okay, I get it, and I think most true crime people do too. We always want to know what happened to the pet, and we're always really mad when those die or killed. So I was obviously worried about this too. Gary let the dog go near a grocery store, and the dog was found. Gary said that he knew the dog had a tracking chip in her and he did not want to be located, but he also couldn't kill the dog. So the dog actually went and lived with Meredith's parents.
I'm glad the dog is okay. Are you telling me this man didn't have an issue taking out a person, but he had more compassion for a dog's life?
Yeah, it's kind of sad.
Very. You said before he was a serial killer, which of course means there were others, right?
Yes. Police are pretty sure that the same person is responsible for several others.
Was this like a series of many years? I mean, how many people are we talking about?
So in October of 2007, 80-year-old John and 84-year-old Irene Bryant took off to hike near the Cradle of Forestry in North Carolina. The two were avid hikers. Not only did they hike around there, but they actually traveled around the world to hike. I know at their age, you may be a little worried about them living on their own, much less going on hikes, but it wasn't something that their family worried about. However, their kids couldn't get a hold of them and neither could the neighbors. So their son finally decides to break into the house and see that their breakfast dishes are still around from the day they went missing. Of course, they file a missing persons report and a search ensues. They do find Irene on November 7th near the Pink Beds area. She had been badly beaten and her cause of death was deemed blunt force trauma to the head. They continue to look because they're looking for John now and they aren't finding him in this area, which of course makes them wonder, could John be responsible for this? Because, you know, it's always the spouse. So they take a look into the bank records and they see that money was removed from the bank. They check the ATM video and I honestly think that they were expecting to see John. They do see a man retrieving money, but it's definitely not John. Actually, they have a hard time like making out the man's face. His face is kind of obstructed. It's hard to see. It's not until more than 3 months later that a hunter stumbles across John's body in the Nantahala National Forest. John had been shot in the head.
I definitely see the similarities, but at the same time, there are a lot of differences too. So does he actually end up admitting to this, or is he convicted of this?
He does actually admit to killing the couple, but this is after he went to court and was found guilty of another murder.
Who was that?
That was 46-year-old Cheryl Dunlap. On December 1st of 2007, Cheryl had made plans with a friend of hers to have dinner that night together. Cheryl decided to take in some nature, and she read and went to the Leon Sinks in Florida. So she was seen on the trails by others, like, just sitting and reading in, like, a resting area. But Cheryl did not make it for dinner that night with her friend, nor did she show up for church the following day. A friend from that church went by her house when she was unable to get a hold of her and was worried because she didn't see her at church. Her friend decided to file a missing persons report on her on December 3rd, 2007, so just 2 days later. Later that same day, they found her car on the side of the highway and one of her tires were slashed. There was a ticket on the car from December 1st, 2007, so the outcome seemed ominous. When looking in the car, her purse was still there, but there was no money in it.
I hate to state the obvious, but if you look in my purse, there's usually no money in there either.
Well, I don't know if her wallet was there, but I do know that her ATM card was gone. They decide they will review her bank records, and that's when they see that money is withdrawn during the time that she's been missing. Just like before, they review the footage, and they see a masked man retrieving money on several different occasions. Cheryl's body ends up being found by a hunter on December 15th, 2007, in the, I'm going to say this the best I can, Apicola National Forest. Just like with Meredith, though, Cheryl's head had been removed and her hands had also been cut off. They ended up finding her hand and heads in a fire pit at Joe Thomas campsite, which is roughly like 7 miles from where her body was found. Of course, her picture was put all over the news, and they had tips come in about Gary being in the area. They had seen him and remembered him for different reasons. Several people had said that he was asking people to help him jumpstart his van. So once the pictures of him were posted as to Meredith, and that's when people in Florida started reporting seeing him in and around Florida in different places during the time of Cheryl's murder, too.
I don't know if I would have automatically linked the Bryant's murder to him, but this is eerily similar to Meredith. Is he convicted for this, or do they do anything since he's already serving a life sentence?
If you like weird, spooky, and strange history, then I have the podcast for you. My name is Brenda, and I'm the host of Horrifying History. Are you into the dark side of history? Horrifying History tells you about the side of history that people don't normally talk about. We tell the tales of haunted places, infamous true crimes, the paranormal, and unsolved mysteries, and then we look to history to see where the truth actually lies. Want to get spooky with us? Get your Horrifying History fix by subscribing today on Spotify, Spreaker, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
So Florida actually does decide to charge him with this murder. Now, the charge for Cheryl's murder came before the charge for the Bryants, even though they were murdered before she was. Florida realizes he's already serving life, but they still want to hold him accountable.
Does he fess up like he did in the Bryants, or does this go to trial?
No, he actually doesn't tell them anything about this. He does go to trial, and he is convicted not only to life, but he received the death penalty there, and they had taken that off the table in Georgia to get him to confess. Not to mention they hadn't actually sentenced anyone to death before him in quite a while.
Just pause it.
I had no idea what you were doing.
How old is this guy when he got caught?
Well, 61.
I'm glad they got justice for Cheryl and all that, but the odds of this guy dying by lethal injection is slim to none, in my opinion. That just rarely happens.
No, I mean, I totally agree with you.
Are there more murders? This is 61, so I don't feel like that's something that he just started in the 60s.
So they definitely believe that there are more murders. The problem is they can't prove them, or they don't have enough evidence to be able to convict him.
Like around 2007, or had this been going on for his whole life?
So I know the GBI said it in an interview that they think he could be linked to more, but he didn't really elaborate on which ones or how far back.
What was he doing until 2007 then? This dude is close to retirement age. I completely get not wanting to work, but I can't just see him start killing people purely for money.
Right, he's odd, but let's get into what I could find about his life. So his mom and dad divorce when he's young, and then his mother remarries when he's 12. At 13, he ends up shooting his stepfather in the stomach. From what I could gather, it was just due to the sheer presence in the home. Gary was very used to his mother to himself, and he did not like having to share her with his stepfather. Luckily for the stepfather, though, this was not a fatal wound.
That's not really typical behavior. Sure, you have some rebellion, but not to that degree. Do you know what happened to him, if anything, for that?
So he was put into a mental institution, but I could not quite figure out for how long. And I couldn't really find anything else about him until he's 18. And at that time, he enlists in the army and actually becomes a really good paratrooper.
Are they the ones that jump from the planes into the military operations?
I mean, yeah, that's pretty much what they do.
I can see that. So he has some adrenaline going and fear of danger, from what I can gather.
Yeah, and I'm not really sure what prompted it, if anything. But in 1967, when he was just 21, Gary has a schizophrenic attack in the military. So he ends up getting a medical discharge from the military.
Is there any information what occurred?
It's classified. Seriously, though, I don't know what happened. I would say he never really found his purpose after that. From then on, it appeared he kind of became a drifter in a way. He doesn't really hold a steady job after that. He starts having issues with alcohol. He picks up sex workers. He is charged several times for public intoxication and for solicitation. At 23, Gary marries his first wife, but they are quickly divorced within 2 years. He does end up marrying two more times, but those two are also both short-lived. Luckily for all of us, he never has any children that we know of, doesn't really want to work, and before he took to killing people for money, he would often scam people for money. He was soliciting money for what he told people was charity, but that charity was just himself. I'm not sure how he ends up being caught for that whole scam, but he does, and he needs a lawyer for this.
This guy's what makes me never want to donate to things. It's also because I'm cheap, but you hear about this so often.
Yeah, this honestly infuriates me because there are so many good, honest charities out there. I would just say don't be bullied in. Just do thorough research and look things up. Of course, this was like the 90s and Google wasn't there to help you.
Right.
So you just had to go with a gut feeling. But Gary finds Sam Rael to represent him in Georgia. I checked and he is still practicing law if you want to look him up or you need a lawyer. He did not sponsor this episode. Sam also, though, has an interest in making films. So somehow the two of them link up in this film called Deadly Run that came out in 1995. Now, please, if you decide to watch this, be forewarned. It is low budget stuff and it never saw the inside of the theater. I don't know where you get it, but Gary is one of the writers for this movie.
Deadly Run. That's what I think of all runs, but what's the movie about?
Okay, brace yourself. This movie is about a man that drops women in the woods and he hunts them for sport. Sam said in an interview that Gary was really out there. He wanted to really add more gore whenever was possible, and they really had to, like, rein him in. Gary found the cabin and the woods where they shot the movie. If you go Google this movie, you'll find Gary's name underwriter. I mean, it's so crazy. He does actually get a job and spends, like, the next 10 years or so working like a normal person until whatever possessed him to start yanking his teeth out with pliers and quit working in 2007. Honestly, I wish I knew more about his life, but up until his started killing people, there wasn't a whole lot that I could find.
I'm not sure why, but with this whole soliciting sex workers things, I'm really kind of surprised he wasn't killing them too, but I guess he only did this for monetary gain, and sex workers aren't usually really rich. So I'm just thinking something significant had to have happened for him to do all this in his 60s. Do you know if he was taking medication regularly for mental health?
In my own opinion, because I don't have it for a fact, I would say probably not. I also say that because we have learned through doing this that a lot of people that suffer from schizophrenia aren't great about taking their medication. It also sounds like he was possibly trying to, like, self-medicate with alcohol. But, like I said, this is just all my opinion, and there's nothing, like, concrete that I can confirm that with.
That's very true. I just have to assume there are more over his lifetime, especially since he was such an outdoors man and living off the land and that type of guy.
Yes. And when you're talking about the solicitation and who's not killing those, he could have. We know that sex workers being killed are notoriously not reported or poorly reported. So that's very possible. I do want to add, if you have time to kill, no pun intended, you can find the interview with the GBI and Gary. It's roughly like 4 hours-ish. They just let him talk in hopes he would reveal other things. This dude is truly full of himself, and he really loves to talk about himself. Something good did come from all of this tragedy. Meredith's roommate began a nonprofit called Right to Hike. They run races each year, and the money went up to put emergency phones throughout hiking trails. It was used for a scholarship and animal organizations. It sadly did come to an end after 10 years, but it's great what they did in honor of Meredith. Also, just be safe when hiking. I would say don't hike alone, but the Bryants were together. But just please be safe. Carry mace, a stun gun, whatever it takes, and be aware of your surroundings. You shouldn't have to be scared to enjoy nature. Just be safe. And if you need the hookup for mace or any other protective things like stun guns, please check the show links, and we will have a link to Ninja Nancy at the Damsel in Defense. She can get you the hookup.
Amen.
We always recommend more bubbly
and less OJ.
Cheers! If you'd like to see pictures from today's episode, you can find us at murder.mimosas on Instagram. You can also find us at murder.mimosas on TikTok, Twitter, and if you have a case you would like us to do, you can send that to murder.mimosas@gmail.com. And lastly, we are on Facebook at Murder and Mimosas Podcast, where you can interact with us there. We love any type of feedback you can give us, so please rate and review us on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.